What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Extreme Drummers Podcast, episode 4. As always, massive thanks to everyone who's still listening and who is messaging me and stuff and telling me you're enjoying it. It's it's really wicked, man, because I'm really enjoying this. So to hear that you guys are enjoying it as well makes it all worthwhile. So thank you so much. Episode 4 this week is a special one. I've been a massive fan of this dude for, well, since I started drumming and since I started getting into metal. Adrian Erlandsson, he's an absolute legend, not just in the metal community, but in the drumming community. And if you don't know who he is, then you've probably been living under a rock. But At the Gates, The Haunted, The Lurking Fear, Cradle of Filth, Paradise Lost, just to name a few of the bands that he's either playing in now or has played in previously. And I've had the pleasure of meeting Adrian a whole bunch of times, and he's just a lovely, lovely person, as well as being obviously legend for various reasons. So yeah, this was a real special one for me, a real treat for me. And yeah, it's an incredible chat. We chatted for a long, long, long time, and I was thinking about editing it right down because, yeah, we chat for a long, long time. But I just thought, screw it, why not just put it up? If people want to listen for 2 hours, then people can listen for 2 hours. If they don't want to listen for 2 hours, then they don't have to. So yeah, but it's a really long chat, and it's just a great chat. It's super, super honest, super candid. A lot of cool stories from the old days, and some, you know, a lot of stuff about what Adrian's up to now. And yeah, it's just wicked. And it was just a real, real pleasure to speak with him. And I really hope you guys enjoy it as much as I did. And so I hope you enjoy. As always, normal places to get in touch and keep updated is Instagram at Extreme Drummers Podcast, or Dan Wilding Drum, which is me. Facebook.com/Dan Wilding Drum, or there is YouTube. Just search Extreme Drummers Podcast. All of these get uploaded to YouTube, and there is also ExtremeDrummersPodcast.com, and that's everything. So yeah, thanks so much, everybody. Really hope you enjoy the episode. This was a wicked one. Here we go. Adrian Erlandsson, Extreme Drummers Podcast, episode 4.
Good to see you, man. How are you doing?
I'm good, man. I'm considering everything. I'm doing all right. How are you? How's life at the moment? How's things?
It's pretty confusing state at the moment. First with the music, but then also when this pandemic started, we decided that we were going to sell our house and move out to the countryside.
Oh my god!
Me and Amber run my wife run a photography studio.
Yeah.
So we were planning, because we had to shut due to the pandemic.
Of course.
So we figured we'll sell the house in London, move out to the countryside, and build a studio.
Wow!
On the grounds, and we found this perfect old house that we were gonna needed loads of work, but it had like all the grounds that we needed.
Yeah.
And then we got a seller or a buyer straight away on our house, but he like three times he dropped his buyer in the chain.
Oh no.
So this has been going on like now for like about 7 months.
And each
time he's lost his buyer, we put our house back on the market. But then you gotta drop the price because it's been relisted.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's just been a bit of a ball ache, to be honest.
Oh, man. But still in the original house that you're still trying to sell? There's been no movement so far. You're still where you were.
None.
Oh man!
And just loads of really intrusive viewings with the corona mask and people being funny about taking their shoes off and stuff. It's just...
Oh my god! So that's an extra thing that you probably weren't expecting to have to deal with on top of. On top of everything else.
No, totally not.
Was that a plan that you had before all of this stuff, or is this a kind of a fresh plan that you've come up with since all this craziness kicked off?
I mean, it's a plan that we had that I sort of wanted to come into place, like maybe when I turned 60, you know, like perhaps in 10 years time.
Yeah,
but actually,
yeah.
Actually, you know, like we don't go out that often anymore. So it's, you know, and the idea of not having to spend thousands of pounds rent in the studio unit seemed like quite... It seemed quite appealing.
Yeah, and, exactly.
And also this, it's an old farm that we're buying actually, and there's no neighbors at all.
Wow.
So then I'll be able to have a live kit at home, which is really appealing.
That's the dream. So, that is the dream.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So you're working towards that dream still.
Yeah. We'll see. I think it'll happen one day.
So what are your days looking like these days? Like what now that you're not obviously touring anymore like any of us, how do you fill your days?
I actually just a couple of weeks prior to the pandemic breaking out, we had some friends around the house, and one of them was a keen cyclist, and he said you should totally come out on a bike ride, because he just bought a new bike, a new secondhand bike, and you should come along. And I came along. I've got this like old steel bike that are like super heavy, and he had this racing bike, and I was just hanging off like a wet flag at the end. Obviously, it's one thing when you're just cycling from one place to another. But when you're cycling like that for exercise, you push in a completely different level, which I just wasn't prepared for.
Yeah.
But I'm a pretty stubborn kind of person when it comes to physical stuff. So I sort of stuck with it. And then another friend of mine who's also a keen cyclist, he said, you can have one of my... He had like 10 bikes in storage.
Oh, my God. Wow.
So he gave me one of his bikes. Which it's like a 10-year-old model, but it's, you know, it's, it was a bit
beaten up.
No, it's not beaten up. He barely used it at all, actually.
Oh, okay. Like your 24-inch kick drum.
Yeah. But since I got that bike in June, it took a few months to sort of get it together.
Yeah.
After the initial. And the weather wasn't quite right in the beginning. But now, since June, I've cycled like nearly 2,500 miles.
Oh, my God, dude. Wow.
So I'm just like completely hooked on it.
Wow.
And from where we live, we live so northeast London. And Epping Forest is just above us. And then we got Harlow on the other side of Epping Forest. And then like you could go up towards Brentwood and Chelmsford. It's just it's stunning. And you don't have to go very far outside of London either to just be on like a country road where all you meet is like some cows in a field.
Yeah, I was
going to
say
incredible.
Some cows and a couple of tractors or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So. I've been doing a lot of that. Also, I have been quite lucky, actually, because last year was going to be the 25th anniversary for Slaughter of the Soul.
Wow.
And we were going to do, like, mainly tour for that. And then in between dates, be at home and prepare the new album, which we have just finished recording and stuff. And... so like I was busy the whole, all of last year leading up to November when I finally recorded the album, preparing the demos for that. And I had some other sort of session albums that I did at home on my V-drum kit.
Yeah.
So it's aside from losing all those things for Slaughter of the Soul, I've been busy.
I was going to say, because it seems like, because you recorded at Grondahl, right, as well?
Yeah.
Fascination Street, as it is, or whatever.
Yeah.
It is, yeah. Yeah. Because I saw you posting about that. And again, I saw you posting about the Austrian band and doing all the stuff in your... Because you've got like a little drum room type situation, haven't you, at home?
That's right, yeah.
And I was thinking, Jesus, he hasn't stopped. Everyone else has taken time off. And now with the cycling, I guess, you've added a whole extra thing on top of it as well.
No, it's great. I mean, I'm completely addicted to having a full schedule. I don't like it when it's empty, and then it never is empty anyway, because we have the studio. There's always something to do.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of, it's a, so day to day, it's my wife that runs it, but I'm kind of like a janitor. there's always something to fix there. And then occasionally, like in the, in between the lockdowns, we had a few shoots that I was the cameraman.
Yeah,
so
I took
the pictures.
So are you still doing do you still do any photography? Because you did what me and Jeff and Bill actually consider some of the best promos that the band has ever had. You know, do you remember when we came to your... Are you still in that studio, or is it a different studio right now?
No, it's moved. That got too expensive, that one. But yeah, we still have that mortuary table that...
That Ben was on.
Yeah,
man, they're still some of the best ones that I think we've ever had, and we always talk about that. We're saying we need to come back to you for maybe for the next album to get them to get some more.
Yeah,
because that was good.
Yeah, for sure. Photography is a big interest for me. So I just haven't done that much band photography since then. It's mainly sort of these makeovers for glamorous ladies that we do, where Amber does the hair and makeup, and or if it's a higher budget, we'll have someone that does the hair and makeup, and then Amber tells them what poses, and because some people haven't been in front of a camera before, and they just want some nice pictures, and she'll direct them, stand like this, stand like that, I'll take the pictures, and then Amber photoshops it afterwards.
Yeah.
So,
well, as you know, it's not very intuitive standing in front of a camera when you're not used to it. I mean, I think everyone in a band understands that, don't they?
Yeah.
How annoying that can be.
Yeah, it's a good way of shutting people up, actually. Most people point the camera at them, and then
they'll
just freeze.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, because with all the you getting into the, I guess it's kind of fitness, isn't it? The bike riding. Have you ever been a fitness guy before? Have you ever got into stuff like that previously?
Well, I did. I practiced martial arts before I joined At The Gates. For about 6 years, I was training this Wing Chun Kung Fu.
Wow. That sounds
serious. I was really young when I was doing that, and I couldn't tell you first thing about it now. I mean, it's like nearly 30 years, or it's over 30 years since I did it.
So no wonder.
It's probably more like 35 years, actually. It's terrifying.
Time flies.
Yeah, it sure does. But I've always sort of been running. Mm. Running was sort of my main thing before, but running around here where I live is kind of a bit shit because it's like tarmac roads and cars. And I want to get to like a field or like a trail. I have to drive for about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
The bike riding came as a nice exchange for the running, actually, because I was starting to feel the running in my knees and in my ankles and hips and stuff. It does eventually if you're running on tarmac.
Tarmac has a big effect on all that stuff, doesn't it? I think.
Yeah, and you know, I'm a pretty heavy guy, so like you slam down on your joints, and after getting older, eventually you burn out.
Yeah, understandably. I was going to say, though, because, like, you've always been, and not only from my experience, but from everyone who I know who's played with you or known you since, you know, for a long time, you've always been an incredibly hard hitter. And is that just kind of the way it comes out with you, or has it been as a result of enjoying kind of, you know, physical activity? Is it kind of a mixture of the two, maybe?
You know, the heavy hitting thing started when we joined forces with Studio Fredman with At the Gates, when we went to record Terminal Spirit Disease. Was the first one where he started like nagging me about hitting the snare harder. And when we came to record Slaughter of the Soul, it was almost to the point where we like moved the hi-hat over to the ride side in order to give enough swing room for the snare.
Wow.
But like, and he was pestering me a lot on that album, because and since then it's sort of like been like ingrained in me. And that album, we changed the drum parts to be like more static and less frilly, all frilly bits. We just cut them out. I don't know if you listen to it, you'll hear like even when the riff repeats, there's not even a crash.
I noticed those types of things. Yeah, and that was intentional, was it? That was totally intentional.
It was intentional. Yeah, just to make it as machine-like as we could with me playing it.
Yeah,
and it sort of came from that. It got like quite debilitating actually, because when we came out on tour, I didn't have any endorsements at the time, and sticks were just breaking left, right, and center. And you know how expensive sticks are when you just buy them off the shelf.
Oh yeah, man, absolutely.
And we were sort of supporting the whole time then, so we weren't making any money. So I went and bought these head drumsticks. You know the and they really like, especially on the snare hand, it really fucked up my wrist. And after we'd done a few gigs, I started getting this really severe pain in my wrist, because like I just had that ingrained in me. I hit harder, hit harder, hit harder.
Like a military kind of like a general, military general, just telling you like hit harder.
Yeah, but like then I think it was because I hadn't been playing for that long. When I'd been playing for about 7 years or 8 years when I joined At the Gates.
Yeah, yeah.
Seriously, I mean, we're practicing and by the time we actually started touring, I just wasn't physically prepared for it. And it was, and by the time the band broke up at the end of that touring cycle, I had like a lot of some pains in my shoulders, pain, like especially on the left arm, like in the elbow, in the wrist, in the fingers and all. But when we formed The Haunted, I sort of tried to hold back a bit. But then when I joined Cradle, actually, one of the people from Vic Firth, the drum company, Marco Socoli, his name was, he was the artist rep then. And because first he just said, I'll just send you some 5Bs. Yeah. And he sent me 5Bs. But then he saw me play and he said, dude, he saw my hat, because I've got like quite big hands.
Yeah,
and he said you should totally like try like a 2B or like a rock even.
Yeah,
and after I swapped to the rock sticks, the hard hitting sort of happened on its own.
I was gonna say they're like tree drums.
Yeah, but like the pain that the stick does a lot more work for you then. Although my playing is still very physical, I've been conditioned now through the years of touring to deal with it, and you only need to push that hard. Like it looks really physical when I play, but like I think I'm not streamlined as a lot of other players, but I guess that's one of the things that I like about the type of music that the bands that I play, because it is so physical, and it's kind of, sometimes I see it like a bit like a fight.
With the drums.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I guess when, you know, especially when you're having an amazing gig, or, you know, and there's an incredible audience and you're feeling good, you can push that kind of, you can push the physical aspect even further then, can't you? Because your body's kind of feeling good. And, you know, I get, is there days though when you're just like, fuck, I wish I played jazz or something?
Certainly when, not so much now with At the Gates, because we don't play those kind of duration shows.
Yeah.
Like, we'll play, like, if we're playing headline, we'll do like an hour 10, hour 15, maybe. Mm. When I was in Cradle, we would do an hour and a half, an hour 40. Ooh, and there was a lot of stuff that was like Barker's drumming. It's, you know, on those albums, for me, was really, really physical and really hard to sort of keep up with. And then you end up tensing yourself. And if you're on, I think there was one year we were away for like the best part of the year. And towards the end of that, I was just in pieces. Like everything hurt. Yeah. And actually, at the beginning of that touring cycle, I broke the metacarpal bone behind my little finger in the right hand.
Wow.
So that's the bone that's behind the knuckle in the hand.
Oh. So like this one here, pretty much.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So, and we had, I think we had 7 gigs left on the European tour. And we couldn't obviously cancel, so I got some strong painkillers and an ice bucket by the drums.
Oh my god!
But I just can't even describe the pain.
Even with the painkillers as well.
Oh, dude, it was nuts. It was especially when you. Because I'm sort of relying on that little fingers for like when you're playing blast or whatever, any beat you're playing, you're sort of relying on those fingers. And like my little finger couldn't move. It was just hanging there.
Oh my God. Like lifeless, like a rag doll.
that was tough. And
wow.
But that sort of afterwards became like a frame of reference for me.
Yeah, of course.
Because whenever else I had an injury, I sort of always thought back to that with the ice bucket.
Yeah, I was going to say, man, that must be like a kind of, almost like a game-changing moment. Like, I can't let that happen again.
Yeah. The other sort of quite serious injury I had was I fell backwards when we were bowling with Brewery.
Oh, Jeff told me this story, actually. Jeff told me this.
Yeah.
Did you break your wrist or something? Was it your wrist?
No, but imagine you fall backwards and you go to brace your fall, and your arm is like down. So like the front. The inside of your wrist gets stretched back.
Extended right back, yeah.
Yeah. And we had a gig the following day. And like my left hand was that fucked that I couldn't even put my double pedal together.
Oh my God.
Like when it came, so I could sort of roughly play like slower beats, but when it came to blast, I just skipped playing the snare. So I just couldn't move my hand. It was absolutely horrible. and
that's an understatement, I think.
that took months to heal. Like literally like 6 months for that to for me not to feel that again.
But it wasn't actually broken, was it? Just kind of like a bad sprain?
I think the muscles and tendons were just overextended.
Yeah.
And then it just seized up in this horrific cramp.
Oh my God.
But it was to the point that I couldn't grip with the fingers.
Pinch your fingers, yeah.
No. Oh. And holding a stick like that and playing the gig like that.
Well, again, yeah. I'm using rock sticks as well. It's not like you're using 7A's or something. Or like... And Brujeria is pretty intense. It's not a slow gig, is it? There's some far shit in there as well.
Yeah. It was a nightmare.
Oh my God. So the physical side of it's pretty much always been there from what you're saying.
It has, yeah.
Yeah, so you're kind of that's kind of ingrained in you now from those experiences. That's interesting though, because like I guess recording in general, because you were really young, right, when you started all the stuff with At the Gates?
Yeah, I was 19 when I joined At the Gates, yeah. And only just turned 20 when we did Gardens of Grief.
Okay, and was it a massive? It must have been some massive kind of learning, like a learning process, like a quick learning process, especially recording with Fredman, I guess, like going from
Fredman we didn't work with till like album number 3.
Yeah, true.
So we'd done like a few recordings before then, but that type of music was so new back then, so there weren't any sort of set out framework for what you have to do in order to qualify being like a death metal band. And we certainly, I think At the Gate certainly made all our attempts at being like a different, doing different stuff, especially in the beginning, yeah, up to Terminal Spirit Disease. We were really trying to sort of push the boundaries of, yeah, what the band was about, you know.
Yeah,
And with that came some really weird drum patterns on the first, like on the first two full length albums. The guitar player that we had at the time, called Alf, he used to sit like up late at night programming weird drum beats, and then like chopped off beats, and then he would make riffs around the beat. And then he'd just show up, oh yeah, the beat goes like this, and play on the tape second.
I'm not sure that's going to work.
Yeah. Oh, there was one song called Blood of the Sunsets. Mm. And when we played it, the beat has this weird splash cymbal choke in the middle of the beat. Yeah. But because I didn't have my kit when we were in the studio, I couldn't reach the splash. That's the kind of, you know, we didn't have a boom stand for the splash. So then Jonas had to come in because like it was so on such like, you know, when you play at the absolute border of what you can do.
Yeah, you have 92% kind of.
In my case, it was like I was attempting to do stuff that I could do, like maybe if I reached 105. And like I had to be super warmed up, and
plus the pressure of the studio, I guess. You had the pressure of actually being in the room, and yeah.
Yeah, and I remember it sort of came to a head when we recorded With Fear I Kiss the Burning Darkness.
Yeah.
Because we went to Studio Sunlight again, and the kit that before he used to have like a D-drum kit there, the old D-drums. Mm. So like everything apart from the snare would be like electronic pads.
I heard that. Yeah, I remember hearing that.
Yeah. But this time we said, okay, we want an acoustic kit. Instead of just renting a bigger car and bringing my nice Pearl kit from Gothenburg, we said, I will just play on the kit that he's got. And he just got some old Rogers kit with like all straight stands and like
good, a jazz kit almost.
Yeah, kind of. And you couldn't tilt the bass drum, so like I had to. So you couldn't tilt the bass drum towards you, and the toms could only be mounted flat, and like it sounds like small things, but when you're playing, when you're trying to do stuff that you aren't really able to do anyway, in the best of circumstance,
and in the studio as well.
Yeah, so it came to this song, and we just kept stopping at this part, and then we had to go back to the beginning because you can't drop in.
So then I said,
can we just stop the cut that splash symbol out? No, it has to be there. And then Jonas, our bass player, came in and did the symbol chokes.
Oh,
so I would hit the splash, and he would pinch it in between.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So, oh, man. See, the kids these days, they don't know how easy they've got it now, right?
I mean, equipment is so much better. Like the pedals that were available early 90s were absolutely shit. I mean, if you wanted a double pedal, like Pearl had these ones with the bent left beater.
Oh, you remember those?
And the lag on the left was just
unbelievable.
Just crazy.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But I mean, till I got hold of a Camco pedal, the chain drive Camco by Tama,
the legendary ones. Yeah.
That was a really good pedal. The action was really good, but then because I was just stomping at the pedal, I wore the link out. Like you went to the music store, oh, I need to buy a new link. Oh, it's not sold in Sweden as a spare part. You do have to buy a new pedal. So, okay, buy a new pedal. From that aspect, it's a lot. The gear is a lot better now.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that aspect of it. I was thinking more along the lines of like recording and writing and being in the studio. But yeah, of course, even gear-wise, it's come so far, isn't it? Like, unbelievably far.
I mean, even like you said, with recording, it's so much easier to record today. And like back then when we did those early At the Gates recordings, it was to tape. And like the first album, you can't drop in unless there's like a stop. So sometimes you have to change the song and put the stop in order to have
to make it doable
to drop in. Nowadays it's like, at least when the project I've done lately, it's like we'll do as long as you can play with high energy, and then we'll just take it from there later.
Yeah, absolutely. So like, in almost separate sections, like two or three separate sections, maybe.
Yeah. So like with the last At the Gates album, I would play like the intro, the first verse, and maybe the first chorus.
Yeah.
And then like a gents would say, oh, no, you dropped a little bit in the energy. Let's go back and come in. And then, so it's kind of, it's creating a dynamics that would be very difficult to maintain during those early years.
Absolutely. And I guess that's why, you know, all the legendary albums like, you know, Slaughter of the Soul and a bunch of albums that you've played on, obviously, but there's so much character to those because you didn't have the option to do it a million. Because even with the most recent Carcass album, you know, I did at the same studio, I did it probably 5 or 6 takes of each track. You know, like probably 5 of not all the way through. Again, same like you. You know, I'd do it in sections, but there was like 4 or 5 different versions of that all the way through. And you just think, like, that physically wouldn't have been possible. Because you wouldn't have had enough tape. There wouldn't have been enough time. You wouldn't have been able to do as many drop-ins. You know, and it's that's, I think there's why there's so much character and so much kind of nuance and stuff to those older recordings, because you physically couldn't do it like that.
Yeah, people were holding on for dear life.
Exactly.
And, you know, I kind of miss that charm. Like on, I think, like, of course, I love the convenience of how you can record now, but like, I really do think that like a huge part of how the foundations of metal today sounds has been lost, because it's been sort of like it's sort of edited. Yeah. To pieces almost, and also because people are able to drop in and do like multiple takes, and if it's not quite right, it gets edited.
Yeah, anyway, and sound replaced like, and all that stuff. Yeah,
like it's sort of losing the struggle and the sort of human aspect of it.
Yeah, I was going to say that's the thing, is it the human aspect is the important side of it. It's almost like, and I guess it's kind of ironic in a way that, as you were saying, when you were recording Without the Gates, you were trying to make it as machine like as possible. Whereas now it's literally machine like.
You know what
I mean? Because it is actually a machine.
Yeah, that is a paradox. I mean, when we did that Slaughter of the Soul album, he said, Fredman said, you need to play to a click track. And I'd never played to a click then. And it was, I just couldn't do it. Like even a four count in, okay, start. And then by beat number 3, I'm out against the click.
Dude, but like it's one of those things that you can't just do it, can you? You can't just like a metronome is you assume as a drummer, you know, oh yeah, everyone can play to a metronome, or playing to a metronome is straightforward because that's what a drummer does, they keep in time. But keeping in time with something that's not you is, you know, because obviously you have your own internal timekeeping and blah blah blah, and you play a certain way. But keeping in time with a click is, it's still a struggle for me. Like, I still have to practice it a lot, you know, especially with, when you're doing exercises and blah, 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 that's one thing. But when you're actually doing a song and you're trying to put feel into it and stuff, and again, the studio pressure and all that kind of stuff with a click, it's still fucking hard, man.
it is hard. I think, it's not a natural thing at all. And I had a really horrible experience, actually, when I joined Cradle. There was some, I can't remember his name now, the producer on the EP that I played one of the songs on when I first joined, before Midian.
Yeah, yeah.
I was from the Cradle to Enslave EP. I played on
EP,
two.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I played on 2 tracks on that. And the producer said, so what's the tempo? Because he was... as I was setting the drums up, I don't know. I need to generate the grid and set the click up and stuff. No click. And he said, well, this is going to be a mess. It's going to be a mess.
Yeah, yeah.
But then it was fine because me and Stuart, the guitar player at the time, just played the song together a few times. Yeah. And that was fine. But when we came to do Midian, like the producer came in and he said, it has to be recorded to click. And then I would go to the rehearsal room a few hours before the band would show up, practice with the click, and then stay after. We'd practice for like 6 hours with the band, Then they would leave. God. Then I would stay and play with the cliff again.
Oh,
and,
my God, wow.
And when it came to the studio, because at this point, we no one had like a home recording setup
yeah,
yet.
Exactly, yeah.
So we didn't have any guitar demos to click. Mm. And then, because all the material had only just been finished before we go in the studio, like none of the guitar players could play to a click. So oh so then God. It was like, so then it's like, okay, how do we solve this? So I recorded that whole album just with a click, humming the guitars in my head.
Oh my God. No the reference first time whatsoever.
No, just humming it.
Oh my God.
The entire Dude. Album.
That's incredible.
And it was like, to this day, I can't think how the fuck I got through that. It
was just,
some of those songs go for, there's like some 9 minute songs on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and the arrangements aren't super straightforward either. There's some no, kind of proggy, I not know, proggy, but you know what I mean? They're kind of all over the place with the arrangements.
Yeah. And yeah.
Oh my God. Wow. And that was, I mean, because in my memory, that seems relatively recent, but obviously I'm getting older. We're all
that's
getting older, aren't we now?
That is 20 years ago now since that
oh,
was
Jesus
recorded.
Jesus Christ, wow, yeah.
21 actually, because it was recorded to that summer of 2000.
That's fucking crazy. Wow, time really does fly, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I remember that really coming out. Wow, fucking hell. But yeah, I was going to say, like, as far as writing as well, like, obviously you're often in a lot of different projects, and I'm sure every different project has a different way of writing. But with At the Gates, especially, has the writing situation changed? Like, I'm assuming back in the day, was it just get in a room, as you said, the old guitar player programmed some drums every now and again, and blah blah blah. But is it still cut relatively traditional to how you would have done it in the old days, or is it kind of modernized now?
Like now, with me being in England and the other ones in Sweden.
Oh yeah, I guess it's tricky anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, like we don't really rehearse, or we don't meet before going in the studio to rehearse the stuff. So it's like for the last two albums, Jonas has written all the music and Tom Bell vocals, and then he's written it with like sort of scratch drums, like
yeah, yeah.
Like here's a Slayer beat, here's like yeah, a slow yeah. 4/4
amazing
beat,
guitar player program drums.
Yeah, and then him and Tompa would have like a good solid idea of what they want the arrangement to be. And they'd send that to me, and I would do versions on my Roland kit,
yeah,
and and send it back and forwards. Then we'd tweak the drum arrangements till we got them to precisely down to the hit what I was going to play, because if we were a rehearsing band, that's what we'd do in the rehearsal room.
Yeah,
you'd decide on all the parts.
Yeah,
prior to going in the studio. So the same thing happened for this album.
Yeah.
And so I knew all the parts before.
Yeah.
I got there.
Do you like to be super prepared with that stuff? Do you like to know exactly what you're going to play, or do you not mind having some kind of improv room here and there?
I don't mind actually either way. I prefer to be prepared, but I don't mind if the tables are turned when you get to the studio. Like for this album and the last one, that was the studio was the first time that I played the parts on a live kit.
Wow.
So yeah,
that
so with this I've sort of got used to that, because I haven't had like a live practice setup since I left Credo, basically.
Wow.
In the UK. So yeah, so getting to the studio, like the first day, feels a little bit weird, but that's usually the day that you're setting up the sound anyway.
Yeah.
And then you get to it. But for this album, Jens had some ideas, like change this drum fill, like changed the accent here, and yeah. Jonas was there in the control room as well, and he had some. So we did tweak it a little bit on this album, and there are some kind of quite proggy parts on this album that
interesting.
that the drums sort of it's sort of freestyled a little bit out of not having practiced, you know. So it became some of the fills became something that they weren't like on the demo, but you know, it's all for the better, I'd like to think.
Yeah, and there's that, and I think, yeah, I guess as we were saying before, with the kind of the human element, I guess those kind of in the moment things that you do in the studio that aren't planned, they kind of, I guess, they keep a little bit of that human excitement, don't they? Which obviously used to happen back in the day a lot more than it does now. So having a little bit of room for improvisation is probably quite nice to keep that, you know, that human thing alive. Keep it alive. Keep it non-machine like.
yeah, for sure. And especially during the sort of more experimental parts on this album, there was more room for going a bit sort of more free.
Do you generally have? Again, it's hard because I guess you've played in so many bands that it's I guess it's all specific in different bands. But generally, do you like to have kind of freedom, or do you like to be given a direction? Like, I can't even remember all the albums you've played on, but there's been quite a few, isn't there? But like, you know, because obviously there was PL, I'm assuming, was very different to how At the Gates is, and you know, and obviously The Haunted and stuff. And is it generally, do you generally have freedom across the board, or has there been specific situations when you've been told it has to be this? Obviously the Splash thing that you were telling me about earlier, but
there is of course freedom and in all of the projects. However, if Jonas, for example, in At the Gates has written a song and it's, you know, this is a slow, heavy song. There's like, there's no matter how much I twist it, there's not going to be a Slayer beat in it.
So, or a blast beat or anything, yeah.
No. But, the sort of freedom happens during the writing process, I guess. Because that's the time that sort of equates to the old school time in the rehearsal room when you wrote the stuff in the room together. So during me doing demos at home on my V-drum kit, I tried to sort of stretch the boundaries when I do the demos, deliberately stretch the boundaries and play stuff that are far from the scratch drums, to give a different perspective of what it could be. And the times that actually shapes the song. Other times it's like, oh no, what's this bollocks? Like, get rid of it.
But the fuck
at times, at times it actually leads to a good new idea.
That's bringing back the human element too, as well. Kind of trying something a bit different and unique. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And all the bands you said, like Paradise Lost, Greg, he's a master drum programmer. He's absolutely
I never knew that.
Incredible at programming drums.
Wow.
And it took like a little convincing for me actually to get him to ease on that a little bit. And because the first album, Tragic Idol, that I recorded with him, he was him and Nick write the music there, and they were very much we have an outline of what we want the drums to do.
And
I said, that's fine, but like it'd be cool if I could sort of make those parts mine a bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's sort of what happened. And when we got to the studio, even then I sort of like changed some of the drum fills and changed a couple of the beats and stuff. And so there was a lot of freedom within
the confinement. Kind of framework. Yeah. Exactly. I guess, I mean, I don't know about you, but I sometimes find having that, almost having like a box, is almost more freeing, because, you know, you have, if you're just given a completely blank slate, there's so many options that you just you kind of shut down a bit. Whereas if you know, well, this is me anyway, but if you have, you know, here's the box that you can kind of improvise within, then it almost brings more it almost brings more ideas. And I find that that's almost a better way to work, when you've kind of got creative freedom, but within a confined space, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I've done a few albums now for a band called Chaotion, some of the members are from Beirut. The main songwriter is from Beirut. He lives in Netherlands now, but I did the last album and one that's about to come out. And some of those songs, he sends me just the riffs. And they are arranged in a song. There's no vocals to it yet, so I get guitar, and if there's keyboards, there's keyboards, then bass, and then do what you want.
Wow.
And a lot of times, like it turns into a song that he hadn't predicted it to be.
Yeah.
And he'll either like it or just, oh no, what's this? You're back to the drawing board.
Yeah.
But like on the last album, there was like sort of a harder turns of no, we wanted it to be this and this. With this last album that we've just done, it's a lot more free. And there was songs where he was just like, yeah, that's great. It's not what I had in mind, but it's brilliant. And we'll work. And the song gets like a new lease of life rather than him just recording the guitars at home to a click. And then I put beats that are completely different to what he originally had in mind.
Yeah.
So that'd be interesting when it comes out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess again, that also goes back to the human element and everybody having such different influences. That, you know, I've said this before on this podcast, but, you know, me and you could listen to the same riff, and, you know, even though we will definitely share some influences and we share bands that we like and blah blah blah, and we're both metal drummers, but we'd listen to the same riff and then we'll probably both come up with very different parts, probably some similarities, but, you know, there would be a huge amount of differences in that. And it's again that kind of shows how important the kind of human element is with all of this, and kind of trying to strive for that as much as possible. Anyway, I think that's really important.
For sure. I'd like to believe, even though we're in a fairly mechanical, mechanically genre, controlled environment now, I think that I'd like to, although I'm a, you know, death metal drummer, essentially, or rock drummer turned death metal drummer, but like, I sort of like to think that I have like a little bit of a little bit of a vibe to contribute to the project that I'm involved with, because otherwise it'd be pointless. If I get hired to play on an album and they have already written all the parts, it's kind of like, you can get anyone to do that, so there's
absolutely. Otherwise, and someone with your experience as well, because I mean, I'm sure you can attest to this more than most, but playing, the more musicians that you play with, the more you kind of learn and the more you absorb and the more, even things like when a guitar player or a member of, you know, the band gives you a drum idea, it's a lot of the time it's something, for me anyway, it's something that I would have never thought of in a million years. And I'm really? You want me to try that? And then you try it, you're like, actually, that was quite good. Shit, that's much better than my idea.
Yeah, I mean, I've sort of put my own pride aside many times. You know, like like I play, I see myself as a drummer for the better of the song rather than for the better of the drum parts. And like I'm kind of like more interested in the song kicking ass than me having some fun solo. Fancy feel. I'm so not interested in that. Like the better part, what's best for the song, no matter who comes up with it, is best in my book, I think.
Well, and I think that's testament to how many bands you've played with and how many projects you're still asked to do and how busy you are. I think the fact that, you know, ultimately that is the most important thing, as much as a lot of us don't want that to be the case, you know, but I totally agree with you. I think the song should absolutely be the most important thing. And I always find that I pull back until I'm told to go crazier, if you know what I mean.
So,
someone shows a riff and I'll play something super basic, and then they can have the, you know, they can have the suggestion to say, oh no, go crazier. I don't want to be the guy that's going fucking crazy. And then they're like, whoa, chill out. You never want to be that guy.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, even if I wanted to, I couldn't. For me, I kind of don't like listening to that kind of music.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, I grew up listening to AC/DC, Def Leppard, Motley Crue, Twisted Sister, and you listen. I mean, Tommy Lee is probably the most flamboyant out of those drummers. But even he plays for the song.
Yeah, so like absolutely.
He plays some flashy parts on the first album. But I think the song was always the key element.
And
that he was,
he's more of a, as well, like, because obviously people treat him as kind of, as you say, one of those flashy drummers, but he was more of a kind of showman. The actual drum parts themselves were super musical, I thought, for the most part.
Yeah.
As you say. It was for the song, kind of relatively straightforward. It was more his kind of look at me when he was on stage, which I think a lot of people didn't like. But as far as, you know, drum parts, I thought he was super musical.
Yeah, totally. Totally. So, and that's kind of going back to like the early years with At the Gates, that's when we changed the sound of the band for Terminal Spirit Disease. That was one of the things that we wanted to, let's peel back all the crazy shit that we can't pull off live.
And stop kidding ourselves.
And sort of like make the song simpler and let the melody of the song or like the riff of the key element of the song come forward. And not like a load of splash cymbals and shit in the way.
Yeah.
And fills that I don't pull off anyway when we play them live. So.
Serving the song, as it were, more than serving yourselves, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so back in, again, like really early pre At the Gates times, were you more of a rock dude? Was it, or were you already kind of a metalhead?
I would like to say that I was a metalhead, because I mean, I go in, but like you call metal then, back then was sort of AC/DC.
True.
I was naturally that into Black Sabbath when I was younger.
Yeah.
And the friendship circuit that I was hanging out in was AC/DC, Twisted Sister, Def Leppard. And a little bit on the countryside. I mean, because you listen to the bands that you saw in the magazine.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
I mean, it was, and also we lived in such a small town, and what was available, I remember the heavy metal section in the record store was like one of those like little crates.
Yeah.
There was like maybe on a good day, there'd be like 50 albums in there. So you were sort of limited to what they had in as well.
Yeah.
But when Metallica came out, I was totally into that. Not that I could play that kind of music then.
Yeah.
Because prior to At the Gates, I had two other bands, but it was like roughly the same members.
Okay.
In one band, I had like many different constellations and different yeah. music styles as we grew into other music.
Mm.
And then when I got to my late teenage years, I was going to a thrash band, like maybe 87, I think.
Mm.
And we were trying to play like Anthrax.
Yeah.
We played some Anthrax cover. And then the singer in the band started getting into Celtic Frost. And
okay.
And then
yeah.
I think he had Scream Bloody Gore as well. And
okay.
And
yeah.
and it's like, well, fuck, let's try to play something like this. And but then, because there were no one else in our little village
yeah,
that were trying to do that. So
yeah.
so trying to work out what the guys were doing on the album was super hard. And
yeah,
like from a physical point of view, like you have no idea what the drums.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, that moves again back to the difference between then and now is, again, I mean, we're obviously a different generation, but even my generation was the same thing. You didn't have YouTube. There was very few videos available of, yeah, especially of your favorite drummers and stuff. So
yeah.
You had no fucking idea what they were doing. You just have to listen to the album as much as possible and try and pick out the tiny little bits and be like, what the hell is that? Surely he can't be playing that. That's way too hard.
I have a funny example of that, actually. When I rejoined The Haunted, there was one song called Silencer. That they said we want to play, and I said like, "What the fuck is he doing?" I was listening to Pear on the album. I can't work that fill out. I just couldn't work it out. And you get a block with something, and it's like the harder you try, the harder it becomes.
The worse it gets. And, yeah.
I went on YouTube. Sure enough, there's some young kid playing it perfectly. And I was like, thank you.
Cheers, YouTube. Nice one.
So
yeah, and these are all the struggles that, well, I mean, you know, I guess we're going to see a whole different generation of musicians. Well, we're already seeing,
I guess,
a whole different generation of musicians now, aren't we?
The level of players in the bands that are coming out now is just nuts.
Yeah, I mean, understandably, though, because they've got all the resources, I guess. You'd be annoyed if they weren't that good, because they've got all the resources.
Yeah, I mean, I think, obviously, I didn't have anyone showing me, like, how stuff is done, and I sort of learned the hard way. But I think, like, if I had someone teaching me along the route, like a lot of stuff that would have taken a lot longer, would have been that knowledge would have been gained quicker, like if you could see, like it's one thing just hearing someone playing something, but if you see them playing it, then like you it's in two dimensions, you know.
Absolutely,
so,
yeah.
You
can take it in, can't you? As opposed to just listening to it over and over, trying to figure it out. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that in combination with that, there's so many more people. Like music is so much more accessible now.
Mm. And again, like you were saying, with the 50 records, like you can go on Spotify and listen to 50 records in 10 minutes.
Yeah, that is nuts. It's nuts. But like, I find it exciting at the same time. I'm not trying to compete with.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? It's kind of you know what Jeff's like. Jeff's very grumpy about all this stuff, and he hates it. But I think I think there's a lot of positives to the fact that music is so much more accessible now. And you know, I'm sure you're the same. But I would have killed to have some kind of Spotify or iTunes, you know, when I was a teenager. When, you know, those years when you're really fucking into music and all you want to do is listen to music. Because, you know, I love music still, but I'm not that bothered about checking out new bands that much anymore. Yeah, you know, if a new band comes along that I like, then sweet. But, you know, otherwise, I'm not going to be hunting Spotify for hours and hours looking for new bands.
No. I kind of... there's a double-edged sword for me, because although I take sort of great pride in still liking the same music and the same still favorite albums as I had fucking 30 years ago. At the same time, I feel like I'm maybe restricting myself in a bit, because there is there is so much good new stuff out there that you're sort of missing out on. And I have, like, in our friendship circuit, there's like people are obviously a lot younger than me. my wife is younger than me, so then it's automatically the people that we hang out with are like, one of the guys that we hang out with, he's like maybe 15 years younger than me.
Yeah.
17 years younger, actually. And he's, like the kind of music that he listens, he's into metal, but like the kind of bands that he listens to is like, I've never heard of them. And if there's a band that I've heard of, it's one that I instantly dismissed.
So why do you think kind of shit?
I'm not gonna name any of them.
I won't make you name any names, but
no.
I think there's something to that, because I guess I would be a similar age to that guy probably, but maybe I'm just an old soul, or maybe because I've been hanging around with older souls for the majority of my drumming life, maybe because my favorite albums and bands are, you know, still the Slayers and the Obituaries and the At the Gates, you know, and all the bands from that era. That there's a handful of newer bands that I really like, but I think, I guess it's mindset, because I know a lot of people older than me that don't listen to older music as well. So I guess it's maybe it's just personal taste, what you want out of music. You know, I don't know.
I think so. I find it's really good fun, actually, when we're out traveling with At the Gates, because both Tompa and Jonas Stålhammar, on the new guy in At the Gates, are massively into discovering new bands. They're super on the prowl the whole time, scouring the internet for these new bands coming out. And although, like, the bands that get presented, like, I don't always like them, but ever so often there's like something. This is good.
Yeah. I guess there's so many, though, isn't there, as well? It's hard to, for me anyway, it's hard to know where to even start.
I think like the main thing for me now is sort of discovering new types of music. For this Lost at the Gates album, I have listened a lot to King Crimson.
Which
was always stated as a big influence for early At the Gates stuff.
And
but back then I just couldn't fucking stand it, because I don't know, like these days I'm listening quite a lot to early albums. Also because on Roadburn 2 years ago we opened a set at Roadburn with a cover of Red. Crimson.
Wow.
And so it took me like about 8 months to learn to play.
It's not the most easily accessible music. It kind of makes sense why you didn't really get it. Because I remember hearing it as a teenager and I was like, what the fuck is this? I guess there's a time and a place, because I remember hearing, I can't remember what it was. I think it was probably Napalm Death when I was a teenager. I was into metal, you know, but I wasn't into extreme metal yet. And I remember, I think it was Napalm Death, and I was like, "This is noise. The fuck is this?" And I think there's a time when your brain is ready and when it's not ready, if you know, or maybe your tastes change. Yeah. I don't know what it is, but and then all of a sudden it just clicked. I was like, "Oh, okay, this is sick. I like this now."
Yeah, I think it's got to do with the circumstance that you're in when you hear it as well. You have to be in the certain types of music. You have to be in the right frame of mind in order to sort of latch onto it.
Yeah, and soak it in properly. Yeah. So do you still mainly not? I mean, not mainly. I'm sure you listen to other stuff, but are you still a big metal listener? Do you still listen to a lot of metal?
I mean, we don't have a stereo in our house. I don't have a turntable. we have this Sonos speaker system.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So so if we listen to music, we listen to stuff that we both like. Yeah. So there's a lot of blues, a lot of 60s, 70s stuff.
Yeah.
And a lot of rockabilly and psychobilly music gets played as well.
That's cool.
But if there is any sort of metal that get played, it would be Black Sabbath and Type O Negative.
Yeah.
Maybe some Monster Magnet. But if I want to listen to early Morbid Angel or something like that, I'll do that when I'm out driving the car or if I'm out on a run.
Yeah, there's a time and a place for that stuff. I guess it's not really chilling with the wife kind of music, is it?
for some wives.
Some people out there they do just chill on a Friday night and listen to Morbid Angel, which is very cool. I respect that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that wouldn't go down in my house either.
it was a funny moment. A friend of ours used to play drums in Marduk.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And Frederick Widdings.
Oh yeah, I've met him a couple of times. Yeah.
Yeah, super nice guy. And they were playing in London, and we went to see them because his girlfriend was here as well, and she's a close friend of both mine and Amber. So we all made a thing of it. And I said, so Amber said, what's Marduk like? she'd never heard them. And I said, well, I'm not sure it's going to be your thing. and we said, okay, let's stand by the merch. And we stood by the merch, and they came on, and she just looked at me and said, can we leave? I think we're in there for 2 songs maximum.
I mean, respect. If you've never heard Marduk before, even staying for 2 songs is pretty good, I'd say.
Yeah. I mean, I quite like that kind of music live. We went to see 1349.
Oh yeah, that's almost another step, isn't it? 1349 after Marduk.
But it was fucking sick live. super good. I loved it. But that I tried to recapture that vibe listening to them at home, and it's just for me it didn't translate.
I guess again that kind of music is very raw, isn't it? And I guess that's why it works so well live. And it's always hard, dude. It's always hard to capture that live feel. I mean, there's probably a handful of bands ever that have really, really done it justice. You know, that live feel. Having a really well produced album is one thing, but having that kind of live vibe is almost impossible to capture, isn't it, in the studio? And especially for as you say, music that's that ferocious and in your face.
I mean, that kind of music needs to be enjoyed live. It's totally a live music, and for me it doesn't, although I liked it live, I wouldn't put it on at home.
I can understand that completely. That, again, that's all taste, isn't it? And everyone's completely different.
For sure. I mean,
and as far as, because speaking of different bands and different tastes, obviously you've always, I mean, pretty much since the end of At the Gates, that the original end of At the Gates, obviously, is that when you kind of started getting busier and busier and you started doing more and more projects, or were you already doing lots of projects in when you were in At the Gates back in the day? Because again, you've always been super busy. You always seem to be in a million different projects. Has that always been your mindset? Or is it kind of just happened that way?
I mean, I like a lot of different types of music, and I love playing in different types of constellations where you get like different musicians. I find it like there's always something you can learn from them.
Absolutely.
And also like the way bands are together is very different.
Yeah.
And I kind of like it on a social level. It's always appealed to me. And when we lived in Gothenburg, or when I lived in Gothenburg, like I played in a few different bands. I played in this band that sounded a bit like Danzig in.
Yeah.
But that was like a case of they had a room next to our room, and you sort of get chatting in between rehearsals, and then, oh, we don't have a drummer, fancy helping out.
Yeah.
And quite a few of the situations that I've ended up in have been just that. I've just been there at the time when the drummer was needed.
So it's a time and a place, almost like luck in a way.
Well, yeah, I think so. And to a certain extent, I mean...
Right place, right time, maybe, is a better way of putting it.
I mean, the fact that I got the Cradle gig was, I mean, a bit of a fluke, really.
Because
I knew them a little bit from this tour we did, where Cradle was the opener, then there was At the Gates, then and after my headlined.
Wow.
That we did a few weeks in mainly Germany, Holland, Belgium, like the early 90s. But like I didn't keep touch with anyone apart from Barker a little.
Yeah.
We sort of snail mailed each other a little bit. But then it happened, I was in Holland playing the Dynamo Festival with the Haunted, and I actually just bumped into Danny at the bar, and they'd had I don't know exactly how it happened, but they just had a shit gig, and the drummer they had at the time had also had a shit gig, and it was his sort of first biggest show that they'd done with him. And then just a few months before that, actually, I'd been to see Dimmu Borgir with Barker in Gothenburg. Yeah. Yeah. And he gave me the phone number to Stuart in Cradle, and he said, "You should totally bring them up, dude. They haven't found someone." But then I was like, my English was so bad back then. So I did, like, the thought of ringing someone, "Hey, Jim."
Just
no way.
Cold calling out of nowhere as well.
No way. And I mentioned that to Danny when I met him in the bar. Funny, Barker gave me Stuart's phone number. And then less than a week later, after I go home, they'd get hold of my number and called me.
Wow.
I think it's really like a lot of the things that have happened to me have been just
those kind of situations.
Same with Brujeria, because I've been talking to Jeff, you know, prior to the 2008 Carcass reunion. I've been talking we used to meet at festivals, whatever, and he'd be saying, "Are you going to do it without the gates?" And then, so those reunions happened the same year.
Yeah, they did, didn't they? Yeah, that was a big year.
Yeah, so we met out at the festivals quite a bit then. And sorry, I've skipped Brujeria now. I'm getting onto the Paradise Lost bit. But at the end of 2008, Jeff said, you know, Paradise Lost hasn't got a drummer. Because Jeff had just left. And they were going to use a session drummer in the studio. And I just happened to run into Greg at the Electric Ballroom.
Wow.
And he's from Yorkshire. You know, like, what's the chances of that?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So, but,
wow.
Yeah, I'm not saying my entire life is by chance, but...
No, of course, but
a lot of it.
But I think there's a lot to be said for, again, right place, right time, and the networking thing. I mean, I hate to call it networking because you know that makes the whole. It makes it sound like it's like me and Bill always say we hate using the term music industry. It is an industry, but you know, it makes it sound so formal and business like, which I hate. But yeah, it's like it's the networking side of things where you meet enough people. Eventually someone's gonna, as long as you can, you know, do if you're a drummer, as long as you can play drums to a good standard and you're a good person, if you meet enough people, you're probably gonna get asked to play in a band, or you know, eventually. And that kind of the more people you meet, the more tours you do, the more kind of as you say, the more people you meet on different levels, the more that kind of presents itself. I can totally relate, man. Everything I've ever done is because of the same thing, running into people or meeting people or touring with someone and getting on with them really well. And then 2 years later, their drummer leaves and blah, blah, blah. So it's a big part of what we do. And it's, I don't know if it's talked about. I'm sure it's talked about a lot, but I don't seem to hear about it that much. You know, people saying the importance of just being a nice person and you know, speaking to people. It's good fun.
I mean, yeah, you think if you take the concept of being in a band, like the thing that you do the least of is actually playing. take a tour, for example, you're playing for like an hour and a half and then you do like maybe a half an hour sound check. So you're playing for maximum 2 hours per day, and that's maximum.
Yeah, absolutely.
All the other time is, you know, wherever you're after your basic needs, you're hanging out with people. Yeah. And if you're an annoying, you can be the best drummer in the world or best guitar player in the world. If you're an annoying twat, no one wants you around. you can get away with being a virtuoso to a certain point, but like if you don't get on with people, you're not going to be around on the next tour.
Yeah, unless it's your band and you're some kind of solo artist, then
But then the other people are going to leave.
Yeah. Oh yeah, exactly. And that's what I mean. It's like if you want to live a very lonely, creative existence where everything is on you and you're the only person in the band that's ever been in the band for more than, you know, 2 years, then that's fine. But you know, but just a warning. As we've said, a lot of this stuff has come because of not luck, but you know, so networking. Have you always wanted to be as busy as you are? Like, have you pushed to be in as many projects, or do you just kind of say yes to most things, but you know, things that you like? Do you just say yes and try and squeeze it in when you can?
I'm sort of a workaholic, and I'm also just full of ideas the whole time. And I just have been really fortunate just to have the option of being in like a lot of bands, you know.
That's true.
And I've been lucky as well that like a lot of the people that I played with have been exceptional. So it's turned into something good. You know, like playing in loads of bands is one thing, but if all the bands are like not that good, then
it's not that impressive.
I think that's a bit of luck as well. I mean, meeting like the people in PL, because I was a fan of PL myself, and like the way I met the guys in At the Gates was just like a pure fluke as well. So it's I'm just you know, I enjoy the creative process. I enjoy playing. I enjoy being on tour. I love traveling, even like the horrible airport early calls.
Oh,
I kind of like that as well. So there was a point where I thought this is too much when I was in the summer of 2013. I was playing gigs with Brujeria, Paradise Lost, At the Gates, The Haunted,
and
Valenfire.
Oh my God.
And it was just it was just not possible anymore, like, to be that many bands. Yeah.
Every single one of those bands was, you know, that they're each successful bands in their own right, you know, so just one of those bands would be busy enough. And again, it's not just the schedules, it's remembering all the different sets and remembering the songs, and that must have been
it was really doing my head in, because like, I'd be nervous that shit, we haven't played together for like maybe 2 months with one band. And because I'm coming straight from another gig, I haven't got time to rehearse. And shit, 3 o'clock in the morning, airport call, try to listen to the songs on the flight, fall asleep, and try to listen in the shuttle to the gig. And it's just, So that's when I decided, I couldn't be in Brujeria anymore. And I couldn't be in Valenfire anymore either. And eventually it came to a point where At the Gates and Paradise Lost were colliding so much, it wasn't possible to be in PL anymore either.
Yeah.
But I think it's definitely on a more sane level now.
Yeah. I was going to say, how many bands is it? I guess technically there's no touring now, but you're still busy. But how many bands is it currently?
So
officially, anyway.
So it's At the Gate, The Haunted, and The Lurking Fear.
Lurking Fear, yeah.
Yeah, and
that's not too bad then. not too bad.
But like, I've got another band that's on the horizon that we're making demos for now. That's going to be, but it's very different kind of more gothy music than previously. So that'd be interesting, and clean vocals as well. So.
Oh, cool. So, and again, it's instead of doing five of the same band, at least you're doing some different stuff to keep yourself interested.
Yeah. totally.
Yeah, and as far as like, I guess with drumming itself, have you had much time with this whole pandemic situation? Because I've found, and I've spoken with, I don't know if you've listened to any of the other podcasts, but most of the other guys I've spoken to, this time has been really good for like honing in on what I was shit at on drums. and trying to get better at that, because you know it's as you know, and probably you still know because you haven't had that much time off. It sounds like, but when you're going full, you know, full force as a quote unquote professional drummer, you just have to be gig ready all the time, and it's very hard to practice stuff that you genuinely want to get better at. And, you know, stuff that maybe isn't stuff that you need directly for, you know, a show. Have you managed to do any of that stuff? Have you managed to kind of put your mind in that place, or are you still just in creative mode and, you know, all that stuff?
So at the very beginning of the pandemic, just like sort of early April last year, I was messaging a lot with James that plays in Decapitated now.
James Stewart. Yeah.
And because we were on a tour together in, he filled in for Witchery. Okay. And then it was The Haunted and At the Gates, also on that same bill. So I was playing two sets and he was playing one.
God.
and he, but we sort of, hung out quite a lot on that tour, and I was asking him, because he's such a fluent drummer.
Yeah, and he's amazing, yeah.
And I was looking at his, you know, if I even could like nab like about 5% of his technique, I'd be in such a good place, and it could make it so much easier for me. And he sent me a few tips, and I was actually trying to learn to play swivel with the feet.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Say, like for all my years, I've just played like all from the hip, basically just stomping
as hard as humanly possible.
or as fast as you possibly. Yeah. But you get to a limit where you just can't.
Yeah, of course.
You just, it levels out, and I think like at a peak on some of the Cradle albums, I think I got to like 210 maybe. I had a back problem, and then I just couldn't play those parts live anyway. And it's fucking shit. And since then, I've sort of been looking for a new way of like getting like over 200 comfortably. Yeah. And James said you got to play like from your ankle,
from the otherwise ankle, it's just saying,
yeah. And I when before we had Valenfire sort of early 2011, I had spent like a few years practicing heel toe.
Oh yeah! Wow.
I spent like about 3 years practicing heel toe.
Wow.
And I finally got it, but it sounds shit acoustically.
Oh yeah,
it really
absolutely,
does.
Man. Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah,
if you haven't got triggers, or if your triggers ain't working, see you later, because it's it's bollocks without
it's
triggers.
Yeah.
So at least how I play it, you know, like it acoustically, it's never as powerful as. Single hit.
I think across the board, I think that's a relatively well known fact. I think that if you play heel toe, I think, again, I'm sorry if I'm offending anyone here, but I think if you don't have triggers, then it's kind of, as you say, it's almost pointless. And I think in a lot of ways that technique is almost made for that ridiculous super fast.
On the latest Chaotian album, there is some 280 BPM heel toe kicks.
Wow.
But I'm never gonna have to play those live. So after that tour where I got to see James play every night, I sort of decided, okay, I'm gonna practice swivel now. And he sent me some exercises, but then we started writing, and the writing was taking up more and more time. So I think I got like about 4 or 5 weeks of solid practicing of it. But then on the new At the Gates album, there's some really tricky sort of proggy parts that demanded more attention, and then like there's no fast kicks at all on the entire album,
so you couldn't make that a priority.
It just like, okay, I've been out like cycling and just shit excuse, really. I think that has to do with what type of band you're playing in, because if I was playing in a band that demanded loads of faster kicks, then I would make that a priority.
But
I think, you know, the age, I'm not making excuses, but the age I've got to, it's like there's so many other aspects of playing drums that I want to explore.
And that it all takes so much time and effort, doesn't it? Every tiny little factor that you want to explore, you're not just going to get it in 2 weeks. It takes fucking ages.
Yeah. It's awful. I remember like when we played the first gig with Valenfire, I was practicing at home, and I used Axis pedals at the time with those E kits.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
and the fucking spring that holds the brass hammerhead snapped in practice. And I don't have a spare, and like I couldn't make the like heel toe work with the bass drum mounted trigger. This is like 2 days or something before leaving for this gig.
And I
was trying to solder this spring together.
No disrespect to Axis, but those things aren't made for heavy hitters, are they?
I just, like, at the moment, I just want to get to where I have to rely less on technology, even on the last At the Gates tour we did in 2019. Mm. Because we have the kick triggers in the front wedges, right? Yeah. So everyone has bass drum the whole time, and like the triggers had a spas with one gig and just sort of loads of double triggering and firing when the bass was playing and stuff, and it's just like we can't have stuff like this. Either it works or it goes.
Yeah, exactly. No malfunctions.
And I was tweaking like crazy in soundcheck, and as soon as we started playing together as band, it wasn't working, and I just couldn't work out what it was, and I didn't have enough time to sort of tweak it anymore. So then I was like, okay, like all acoustic then.
Yeah.
But then you're faced with this thing. Because you haven't heard the acoustic kick for years playing this stuff. You've heard the trigger. And then I was playing two kicks then as well.
Yeah.
And it was a real, real shock to me, actually. Because I have like a little in-ear mixer that I get sent the kick drums to. Like, I don't remember feeling like this uneven between my legs.
Wow.
And it took like the whole, sound guy said, it sounds great out.
Yeah.
Out front, like, I can tell that your left leg is weaker, but I just turn it up.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
like, it just had like the most adverse effect on my confidence, you know, for the playing.
Yeah.
And it was just, so like when I got back off of that tour, that tour was preceded by the tour with James.
Oh shit!
So I was like, just
right,
like,
I need to practice.
At the end of 2019, I was just like, I need to really readdress
what's
happening. Yeah. But we'll see what happens now when gigs start happening again. Have to get like a live practice set up together.
Yeah, it's such a different beast, isn't it? Triggers versus mics. Like, I mean, much like you, like I'd only played triggers in every other band that I'd ever played in until Carcass, and you know they were like, no fucking way, you're not using triggers.
Yeah,
and I was like, what? Well, why? You know, please. and I'd honestly, because you know the first album we recorded, or the only one of two albums that I've recorded with them, Surgical Steel, that again there was no triggers in the studio, not even for monitoring.
Yeah.
And it was just like, it took, I'd probably say, a good couple of years to get used to, like, truly comfortable with playing an acoustic bass. And that sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? It sounds so ridiculous that an acoustic bass drum, because it's not just I don't know, it's so many things. It's the way it feels different without a trigger, because when you hit a trigger, no matter how hard you hit it, you still get exactly the same response out of it, and you usually have to have the drum muffled a lot more so the drum doesn't respond as much. You can tighten the head more, blah, blah, blah. There's so many different aspects to it. And then obviously, as you say, like when you come to do like, you know, like an extended section of double bass, you're like, oh, fuck, my left foot is terrible. It has no power in it whatsoever. Shit, I've never noticed this before.
Yeah.
And it's a real, I have no problem with triggers, but it is amazing how different the two things are, and they are completely different disciplines. Because playing with triggers, I find a bit confusing playing with triggers now, because I really lean in, I bury my beater in the head a lot more now instead of bouncing it off, so I get loads of double triggering. Because the beater kind of hits and then rests, so it does like a bubba.
Yeah.
Where I'm digging into the head more, and I get and now I'm just like, fuck, I can't get used to trigger. I'm the other way around now. Like, I can't get used to using triggers again. So it's amazing how it's a learning curve on both sides. When you just think, triggers is triggers, and then mics is mics. It's a completely different ballgame. It completely changes the whole feel of your playing. I feel it's such a crazy learning curve.
Completely. I look forward to getting back on the live kit, and if house move that we're planning happens, I'm so looking forward to setting up a live practice setup at home which is mic'd, you know, because also the way that you hear a live kit through when you're sitting down playing it is completely different to what you hear when you put it through microphones.
Absolutely.
I could go on forever about that, but like it's something that like I'm really looking forward to, like hearing the dynamics that I'm hopefully able to put into the mics in a different way than all well and good. I've got like a really nice Roland V drum kit, but it's not the same thing.
I totally agree, because again I'm in the same situation at the moment. I've got just an electronic kit, and they are insane, especially with all the tune track stuff and, you know, the superior drummer
I'm still in the booth, but it's not
completely soundproof, and I'm on a new build kind of estate thing, and I live quite close to my, like, a lot of neighbours. I've got quite a lot of neighbours, and because almost everybody's working from home around me, they didn't tell me to stop playing my acoustic kit, but I'm trying to be a nice neighbour, should we say.
Because, for sure.
And because the kids are at home more these days as well, and my youngest one has to nap in the day and he can hear it in his room, so it's kind of like, it's kind of, you know, again, I'm very lucky. I've got a drum room, and if I wanted to, I could use the acoustic kit, but I'm trying to be nice. And when things kind of ease up a bit and people go back out to work and the kids are back into childcare more, then I'll definitely bring the acoustic kit back. But for now, I'm trying to be a nice neighbor, basically.
So can you hear the kit clearly outside of this booth?
Yeah, you can hear, because the booth is inside my garage, and my garage is like a brick built, just a regular garage with an up and over door. And my wife says, I guess you'd have to try and, I'm trying to figure out how far away it is from the living room where my wife sits and watches telly. But when she's in the living room with all the windows closed and the telly's on, the living room's really close to the garage. She says she can hear it, but it's not really that noticeable. You know, it's kind of like a low rumble. But in the summer, and it's getting to the summer now, and everyone's got their windows open. If you've got your windows open, you can hear it. Again, it's not super loud, but it's obvious that it's drums. Do you know what I mean?
So, and like, enough to piss people off, probably.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I play, like, not consistently, but I try and play like at least a couple of hours a day, 2 or 3 hours a day. Not obviously full 2 or 3 hour chunks, but, you know, 2 or 3 hours a day of that noise while people are working with their windows open and blah, blah, is a bit like, you know,
medium and no success. One's...
exactly. And no one's complained yet, but, you know, I speak to my neighbors and, you know, they always talk about, oh yeah, heard you drumming the other day, blah, blah. You know, I'm like, oh shit, ooh, that was a little sly, passive aggressive, you know. So I think, but there is, you know, there is a lot of I think there's a lot of positives to the electronic kit, not only because of the, you know, they're almost silent. Not obviously, you can't get completely silent with drums because you still whack, especially as hard as you hit them. But like from a writing perspective, it must be quite
they're
handy.
Incredible. They're absolutely incredible for that, and you know, like all the bands since probably. I think since Damnation and a Day 2003.
Yeah.
Like pretty much all the albums I've been part of, I've done demos on a Roland kit.
Wow. Wow. So, since then. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. So I had a TD 7 and I had a TD 10. Then I had a TD 10 with a TD 20 brain. Yeah. And now I got the TD 30 kit.
Yeah,
I haven't got the TD 50 like you yet, but I'm not sure how much difference it would make. Like, I'm not using the sounds from the Roland anyway.
That's the thing, man.
Tune track sounds.
Yeah, the only thing that I mean, like they're all great, and I had the TD 30 for about 8 years, 9 years before I got the 50. Yeah. And the only thing that's really good from the way that we use, because I'm the same as you, I use it with the tune track stuff. The only real positive versus the TD-30 is the 14-inch snare, and that's pretty much it.
Oh, yeah.
So the snare kind of feels more realistic. But other than that, as a module, the modules where you spend the money, really, isn't it? I mean, because the ride is bigger as well. It's like an 18-inch ride, which is cool. And they said because they're USB connected instead of jacks, and they say that it's more sensitive and it's better response. But I don't really notice that on the ride. I notice it a bit on the snare, but it's more the size thing that I find is really good, aside from anything else. But as far as the actual module, it's not, you know.
I don't know if the software has been developed to make use of all the different dynamic levels that the TD-50 is capable of, especially on the snare and the on the ride. But it'd be interesting in a couple of years' time when the next version of Superior Drummer comes out, I think we're going to see a massive jump in quality.
Yeah, absolutely. Superior Drummer 4, whenever that is, whenever that arrives. Which will probably
there's
be...
There's so many good like plugins now. So that is pretty... That's another thing that's pretty cool about the E-kit setups that you have... You know, like you could swap from a Bonham kit to like a, I recently got Get Good Drums. And after seeing you playing it, actually.
Oh, wow. Cool.
I decided I'm getting this.
Awesome.
I struggled for ages with the cymbals.
The cymbals were tricky. They took me a while to get down. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think I have them down properly yet. It's for demoing purposes and day to day practicing. It's invaluable. I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah, and again, you can just kind of play as long as you want, really. And I feel there's almost like because the you know, because it's mesh and it is easier to play. Let's be honest. I'm sure you find when you go into an acoustic kit, it's like playing on a bunch of pillows after playing. kit.
I like to think that I play the same way on my electric that I do on my on my live kit. But I noticed very obviously now when we did the Last at the Gates album that it's not the same, especially if you have on the bigger floor toms.
Yeah, of course. Think about that. Yeah. Mm. Wow. Yeah, they're the little things, aren't they? That you don't quite think about until you're in the moment. Like, oh shit, this is 18 inches versus 12-inch mesh pad. That's a lot of space.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, but what was I going to say? I was going to say one more thing. I've realised I've kept you for ages, so I won't make this too much longer. I do apologise.
That's all right.
Oh yeah. So, did you move to the UK when you were with Cradle? Was that your initial move to the UK?
That's when I moved here. Yeah, in 99. So this year it'll be 22 years.
Wow, dude. Jesus. Yeah. And now with everything going on, I guess you probably want to escape.
You know what? I always liked the culture in the UK. Although I do occasionally miss Swedish food. I've noticed there are quite a few Swedish foods shops that have popped up actually.
So
I could get the bare sort of essentials. There's even a Swedish bakery in London. They bake like Swedish cakes and Swedish bread and like cookies and what have you. And that was the toughest part actually about moving, because you have your favorite foods that you just couldn't get here. And it's subtle differences that, like, you're like the brand of macaroni that you buy. It sounds silly, but like, oh, what the hell is this? Like, I can't find anything that's similar to what I'm used to. But now I've been here so long, you know, like, I've sort of embraced the wide culture. The different types of restaurants and stuff that you can go to, like from all over the world. It's London or England is such a cool place for that.
Yeah, I guess that's one thing. We've both been lucky to travel a lot, but that's one thing it's quite nice about the UK is it does seem to be pretty multicultural, and you can find a lot of cool stuff that isn't necessarily from here that somehow worked its way into the culture, which is really, really cool. I like that. You can, especially food, because our food traditionally is a bit shit. So we have to steal food from other people to to make it somewhat manageable.
I didn't say it. You said it.
Yeah.
But, I do like some traditional UK food, actually. So it's
not too bad.
It's all
not
good.
Too bad.
No, okay. It's good.
That's cool, man. Well, yeah, I don't know if you know, but I do. I like to do these little quiz things at the end of every episode. It's like
that was a nice surprise.
Okay, it's like I call it the either or game. I don't know if there's a real. I don't know if that's the real name of it. But I'll give you two things, and you have to tell me your preference of the two things. That I say. Do you want to go for it?
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Okay, cool. Right. So, and this will be the last thing, and then I'll let you go because I've kept you for 2 hours.
That's cool.
Okay, cool. So, coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Coffee. Respect. Have you learned to like English breakfast tea? Are you an English breakfast tea guy?
I drink tea occasionally, but like I like that rush. I have three different types of coffee makers at home. I'm totally into coffee.
Oh, are you a snob, or are you just into it?
I wouldn't say a snob, but like I grind my own beans and I have an espresso maker, I have like a nice filter maker, and I have a percolator. So I do.
Wow.
I do. I am into coffee. Yeah.
That's pretty serious. I like that. I like that. Cool. Right. So, morning or evening? Are you a morning or evening person?
Morning.
Respect. Do you wake up early?
Considerably earlier than my wife. If I try to watch a film in the evening, I have to sit upright, otherwise I'll fall asleep. And it doesn't even have to be that late.
Well, yeah, dude, this is a late night for me right now. This is for anyone who doesn't know, it's 10:20 p.m. in the evening. So that's how rock and roll I am at the moment. But I've got young kids. That's my excuse. But cool. Okay, so summer or winter?
Summer, I would say. Probably winter when I lived in Sweden, where there was proper snow.
Yeah.
Where there was proper snow. But like when you get like those hot half measure winters with just
rain.
Slush puppy on the street cold rain from the side, it's just horrible. summer otherwise. I like scuba diving and now cycling, of course, and running.
Yeah,
and you know, I prefer summer for sure. And barbecues, of course.
Oh man, I'm excited. Oh dude, if you move out to the countryside, that's going to be amazing. Getting some serious barbecue action going on. Right, so what are we on? Oh yeah, beach or countryside?
Countryside.
Yeah,
for sure.
I can understand.
I mean,
that.
I do like the ocean, but I don't like to lie and just fry myself in the sun.
Yeah.
Like we'll go diving or snorkeling or something, and then we'll go inland.
Yeah, yeah. Fair enough. Right, this one could be controversial. London or Stockholm?
London.
Oh, really? I guess you've lived there, but still. Yeah,
for a long time. I mean, Stockholm's a nice city, though.
I love Stockholm.
If I was going to live in a city, I'd live in London. Which I do anyway, but
exactly. Have you ever flirted with the idea of going back to live in Sweden?
No, not really. I mean, because I've got with me and my wife, I've had the studio now for like over 10 years.
Yeah,
and that could never be run in Sweden.
Yeah,
and so not really. We'll see. I'm not saying no, but like for the time being, definitely not.
For the foreseeable future, you're a Brit.
Yeah, definitely.
I feel sorry for you. No, I'm joking. Right. Okay. So, crisps or chocolate?
Oh, crisps.
Oh, you're a savory guy.
Yeah, totally. Oh. I'm all about crisps of different flavors. And
surprising. Nice.
Sweden, I'm going to stick my head out a bit and say that Sweden actually do the best crisps in the world.
Wow. I don't think I've ever had Swedish crisps, so I can't comment on that.
But at the same time, I've tried to introduce some of my friends to Swedish crisps.
Yeah,
and they're just like, "What the fuck is this? Get it away!" So,
what's different about Swedish crisps?
Well, I would say generally they're thicker and and they have that wavy
crinkle cut. Yeah,
and also more adventurous with the flavors, I'd say.
Interesting. I need to try some Swedish crisps.
There's some really good ones from the UK, but like for a while it was sort of like Walker style crisps, like really thin.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Airy.
Airy, yeah. But I do like some UK crisps, like McCoy's.
Yeah, yeah. They're thick, aren't they? They're thick as fuck.
Actually, some of my favorite UK crisps are Brannigans. They're really hard to get hold of.
Oh,
you can only get them in pubs.
Yeah, and I've seen them. I've never had them. I've seen them, yeah.
They have one roast beef and horseradish crisps. They're super good. But yeah, definitely a crisp man.
Oh, well, okay. So this might make the next question not so important. Dairy milk, or is it pronounced Marabou? Or Marabou, you know, the Swedish chocolate.
Yeah.
Yeah, dairy milk or Marabou. It's Marabou's good, man. I ate loads of that when we were recording the album.
they've changed the recipe on that. I don't know what the, something to do with the fat they use in the chocolate. It's not quite as good as it was up to some early 2000. I'm going to say Marabou anyway. Because they do some really good flavors.
Yeah, that's what I like, dude. There's the one with the, is it Ritz crackers in it? I think it's Ritz crackers. Yeah. I mean, on paper, that sounds ridiculous, but it's so incredibly tasty.
I had one now when I was in the studio with salty licorice in the chocolate.
Oh, and
my God. crispy bits of salty licorice.
Oh, okay.
Super good. Super good.
That's very Scandinavian, right? The salty licorice.
There again, I had dairy milk with the Oreo bits in.
Oh, yeah.
Have you had that?
Yeah, that's good.
That's
game changer. I eat that way too much. Oh, right. So I'm never going to let you go, am I? I've got loads more of these questions. Right. Coke or Pepsi? Or do you not drink either? You can say no to either if you don't drink them.
I like both.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
Not strong either
way.
I'm
not fussy either. I'm not too keen on Pepsi Max, by the way. So
yeah.
Have it.
Well, you know, I've told this story before, but I'm going to tell you anyway because you know him very well, obviously. Chris, Mass, me time. Chris Mermod. You know when you go into a restaurant and you ask for a Coke and they say, oh, we've only got Pepsi, is that okay? You know, most of the time everyone says, yeah, that's fine. Chris is the only person I've ever met that said, no, I will have a water.
Yeah. Actually, we have a tech in at the Gates camp that he's just, no, thank you, water or wine instead. Like, if they don't have it, like the normal full fat coat or
yeah,
sugar
that's
coat,
the same. Yeah, that's the same with Chris, yeah. it's obviously more of a thing than I realized it was. I thought everyone just said, yeah, it's fine. Right, cool. Okay, so YouTube or Netflix?
Oh, no. Fuck, that's a difficult one.
It's tricky, that one, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know. I use them for different things. Netflix for like the end of the evening watching. YouTube for sort of during the day.
Yeah.
I want to watch Netflix during the day generally.
Because it's too distracting.
If I'm watching something during the day, it's going to be YouTube.
Yeah. So you're basically a 50-50. You can't choose. There's no preference.
Yeah. No. I would, like, if I have to choose, I'd probably say YouTube.
Yeah, I agree with that. There's maybe a wider variety of things that you can find on there.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Right, I think I probably know the answer to this one after this conversation, but running or bike ride?
That's very difficult as well. At the moment, it's bike riding, but, like, there's something I love about running that is... as soon as you stop, like it stopped moving your legs, you stop basically. Yeah. So like you get nothing for free with running. That's why I like that. But there's so many aspects of bike riding that's absolutely absorbing. Like seeing the landscape, obviously the physical exercise and pushing yourself, but also then there's all the gadgets that come with it, and like the Lycra clothing, and like I haven't bought my own. So I'm looking at bikes, but like I got to wait a while. But like the tech in bike riding is just silly. I mean. Everything made of carbon, and then electronic shifting gear. Stuff.
Oh my god!
It's nuts.
It's that whole thing where you know, like, obviously technology is advancing so much in everything we see. You know, like computers and phones, but there's so many industries that probably both of us don't even know about where the same amount of technology is moving on. Like you said, like, you know, like in bikes, like I wouldn't have even thought about that. But of course, bikes are like space bikes right now, probably.
Yeah.
Oh, and there's so many other industries where that kind of stuff's happening and we don't even know about it. It's terrifying.
Yeah. But I've been a fan of gadgets. That's one of the aspects that grew me into it as well.
It adds more. Yeah, exactly. Even more eBay scrolling.
Oh, yeah.
Right, cool. Okay, sorry. I will let you go eventually. Right, the next few are music/drum related ones.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay, so studio or live?
Probably live. Okay. I love being in the studio, but like the songs come to life when you play them on a stage, which is, it's incredible.
Irreplaceable, yeah, but, absolutely, I agree.
Yeah.
Festival or club?
That's a difficult one as well. I would probably say, I don't know if I can choose.
They've both got so many good different things, haven't they?
Yeah, a festival probably.
Yeah?
Festival.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
When you get a good one, it's a life changer sometimes, isn't it? Like playing those massive stages if you have a good show and great crowd.
Yeah, but then also when it's shit at a festival, it's absolutely terrible.
it's worst ever. Yeah.
Like a shit gig at a festival is way worse than a shit gig in a club, I think.
It's so true, yeah. It's so true for so many reasons that we won't go into now, but yeah.
Yeah.
I totally agree. Right, this one could be controversial. European tour or US tour?
I'm going to say US tour. Because
interesting.
I love the landscape. It's like traveling to different countries when you're in the US.
Yeah,
like different parts of the US. It's just, and I love the food there.
Yeah,
and usually the buses and the traveling accommodation is better.
The buses are really nice, aren't they?
Yeah, and it's like the country is sort of built for a life on the road more than in Europe. You get to certain parts of Europe and it's closed after a certain time, whereas in the States most of the time if you're fairly civil
something that's open. Yeah. We were saying I can't remember who I was saying it to, but a day off on a Sunday in a lot of mainland Europe is just the worst. Nothing's open, nothing to do, nowhere to go. You just gotta sit in the bus or in the hotel and just hope for the best.
Yeah, so definitely US tour for sure.
Respect. Cool. Okay, so double pedal or two single kick drums?
I've gone back and forwards with this over the years, but I'm back on double pedal.
Yeah, do you prefer in general?
Yeah, because just physically it brings a tighter setup, and because I'm older, I prefer to make stuff easier for myself. And like a big double bass kit is just equipped with so many physical problems for me.
Yeah, and the tuning to bass drums to sound the same and all that. Oh, fucking crazy.
Yeah, that as well. But like, till I got my Charles Capito pedals, I hadn't found a double pedal that actually could keep up with. With it, but like now that pedal is that good with the left that like I have no reason
no
to have
lag
kick
whatsoever. Yeah, no latency on that left pedal whatsoever. Yeah,
no.
And I guess that's the ideal, isn't it? As a perfectly balanced double pedal is pretty much the same as two single kicks almost.
I put them aside or put them apart for two kicks for a while. And that was good, but I mean, the distance between the hi-hat and the ride becomes too big for me.
Yeah.
And like I get this pain in between my shoulder blades. when the kit gets too big.
Too wide.
That's basically why I prefer to have it tight the setup and with a double pedal. It's just so easy.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Where am I? I've totally lost where I am. Right, wood snare or metal snare? Do you have a preference or do you like them all?
I really don't mind. If it's a good sounding snare, I don't mind.
Okay, in the middle. I like that. Cool. Okay, this is the final drum one. Triggers or mics?
I would have to say mics now.
Yeah, although I can, as we were saying before,
although it's pretty exhilarating for me when the triggers work and the heel toe works. That's pretty exciting. But when the same said the situation fails, it's fucking nightmare.
Yeah.
It really is.
There is a lot less to go wrong, isn't there, with the microphones?
Yeah.
I remember we did some shows. Obviously, I played with Hemshall Byrne for a bit, but we did some shows with them in South America. And Chris, the drummer, brought his trigger module set up. And I was setting my kit up and I had no cables, pretty much, apart from my little in-ears and, the little in-ear thing that I've got. And he just uncoils all these cables and he just looked at me and he was like, fuck you, man, I want that. I was like, yeah, it's great not having cables.
I mean,
one big positive of microphones.
For sure. It's with way less that could go wrong. And I've tried to sum up how many different things can go wrong on kit. And it just there's a never ending list of things that can happen.
Exactly. And you have to deal with it in the moment whilst you're playing on stage as best you can.
Exactly.
Right, cool. So final little thing. If you could do it, it might be too tricky, but I like to do like a top three thing, and I do it different every week. Top three festivals as a performer, if you can do it. It could be too hard. I'll narrow it down to Europe, European festivals. I mean, that's really the main place for festivals.
Okay, well, in that case, I'm going to say Brutal Assault, Hellfest, and Grosspop.
Oh, they are three good choices, dude. Respect.
But they are good for different reasons.
100%,
I would say they could easily share the first place.
For different reasons, yeah.
Yeah, for different reasons, they are all absolutely incredible to play at.
Yeah,
and it's hard to put them in rank order.
Absolutely, I totally agree. They're great choices. Great choices. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But those three for sure.
Yeah. Oh, that's got. I thought that would be harder, but yeah, it makes a lot of sense. There's three very, very good ones. But yeah, man, that's everything. Thank you so much for.
No, it's been great. It's been really good fun.
Yeah, man, and thank you for agreeing, and thank you for taking the time. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. It's been really cool.
I have. It's been excellent. Thank you.
No, man. Thank you.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. And it's nice to. It's just nice to catch up. I don't think we've ever really had a long nerdy drum chat like that before.
No,
not that long anyway.
No, we haven't. No, not this long. No,
exactly.
It's been great.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it too. Hey, have a wicked evening, man. Thank you so much again. And yeah, let's keep it.
You too, mate.
Right.
Okay.
Take it easy, man.
Cheers.
Thanks, dude. Bye. Bye.